From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made in 1920 along the Ohio River. A man named Harland established a ferry boat company between Jeffersonville and Louisville. It was a rather rapid success, and this 30-year-old was probably surprised to make so much money so quickly. He cashed his shares of the company just 2 years later, made a pile of cash, and used that money to establish a company that manufactured lamps. Bad timing. That was when another company called Delco was getting into the lamp business. Harland's company flopped and his money was gone. And that began a string of failures that, thankfully, most of us will never experience, at least not at that level. Harland got fired from nearly a dozen jobs. Then he opened his own restaurant, and that failed. Time after time, his big idea became a big mistake, and when he turned 65, he was basically broke. So he drove around to old, fading diners and promised that his chicken recipe would revive them. All he asked was a nickel commission on each chicken, or so the story goes. He slept often in his own car. Harland would later become known as Colonel Sanders, and after years of failure, he built one of the most successful companies in the world. Now, it is not enough just to say, see? Learn from your mistakes. And economics writer Megan McArdle has written one of the most comprehensive looks at the potential value of failure in her new book, The Upside of Down, Why Failing Well is the Key to Success. McArdle, among other things, writes for Bloomberg View, but you've probably seen her work in The Atlantic, Newsweek, Daily Beast, as well as many other publications. And Megan McArdle joins us now in Connections. Megan, thanks for taking the time.
Thanks so much for having me.
You've got a localish connection here anyway, don't you, in the western New York Finger Lakes area?
Yes, my mother grew up in Newark, New York, nestled on Route 31 between Syracuse and Rochester.
Very good. So we'll claim you as much as we can, but now you're in Washington, we know. And the subtitle of your book, again, The Upside of Down, Why Failing Well is the Key to Success. The subtitle might catch some readers off guard because we often think failure is failure. So what does it mean to fail well?
This is a really important thing because there's two ways that you can go wrong. And one is to say, you know, failure is not an option, which is just, it's great in movies, but it's not true. Failure is always an option. And to say, well, I don't want to fail, so I'm going to do everything to avoid it. You know, as if you've never failed, then you have not taken enough risks. You've only been doing super safe things and not really living up to your potential. On the other hand, there's a way of saying, well, failure is great, it's really important, it's risk-taking, so I'm just not going to pay any attention at all to the downside and go and try anything that occurs to me. And that's another way of going wrong. So, you know, it's important to figure out, first of all, to be willing to continually take those risks, meet those challenges, expand your horizons, but also to prepare for it smartly, and even more importantly, when those failures come to us, to pick ourselves up and move on, learn what we can, and then let go of it, and not cling to the failure, not let the dead past sort of, you know, wrap around us in chains and drag us down like an anchor, but instead to make it a stepping stone to something better.
And we're going to be getting into some of the examples that you write about in the book in just a minute, but I have to say that one of the most striking parts of the book to me was that you read that we tend to overreact to the best or the worst events in our own lives, or perhaps we assume that the worst events will be monumentally bad for a long period of time when that's typically not true, and we assume that the best events are some kind of long-term panacea, which is also probably not true. How does that factor into your work in this book?
Well, it's really important because when we prospectively think that the highs are going to be higher and the lows are going to be lower and that this is, and I've been there. I wrote this book. Part of it is autobiographical. I've been long-term unemployed for 2 years. I was the master of almost getting jobs. You know, I've had a broken engagement. I've been through a lot of the big life events and they did feel terrible. So the message of the book is not like failure is going to stop feeling bad because failure has to feel bad in a way. Failure is how the universe tells us something isn't working and that we should stop that. And if you don't, if it doesn't feel bad, we wouldn't stop. But that said, you know, it's also true that it's not as bad as you think. That how many people look back on their lives, I would say almost everyone that I've spoken to for this book, and just generally people who've come up to me and talked to me about the book, is that you look back on these moments that you thought were the worst thing that ever happened to you, and it often turned out they were also the best thing that ever happened to you. And I look at that in my own life of you know, being unemployed for 2 years was actually what enabled me to become a journalist, which is my dream job. I get up every morning excited to go to work, but that wouldn't have happened if I hadn't lost the management consulting job that I thought I was supposed to have and spent 2 years trying to figure out what I was going to do for the rest of my life. And just as with Colonel Sanders and with my own boss, Mike Bloomberg, who actually started a phenomenally successful company that made him a billionaire with his layoff money from Salomon Brothers, a trading firm in the 1980s, that these things, they're not just, they do close one door, but they open other doors that we never would have considered if the failure hadn't come first.
My guest is Megan McArdle, the author of The Upside of Down, Why Failing Well is the Key to Success, the book out and available now. And a nice kind of a guide if you know anyone who is taking a risk. But Megan, you talk about, again, failing well. And some of that is understanding that a lot of the first shot you take isn't going to pan out beautifully or make you a pile of money. What are the important things that we can do to put ourselves in position that if the first startup or the first venture does not work, we are not crippled or have to go back to some kind of a job that we loathe or don't want to do?
Right. This is so important. So the first thing that you have to do is prospectively. You think about, I think the two most important things that you do. The first is listen to the naysayers. That doesn't mean let them tell you not to do what is your dream or to take a risk, but it means, you know, everyone has that guy in the office, right? The guy who can always tell you what's going to go wrong with anything that you propose, and everyone hates that guy. But that guy's actually really valuable because that guy is laying out everything that could possibly go wrong, and that doesn't mean that you have to let him stop you. But you should view that person as an asset. This is the person who can tell you what's going to go wrong with your plan. And then as you plan around those potential holes, he can also be your audit check, because the second thing you really need to do after you've prepared for failure, understood that that may happen, it's just inherent. If you are doing something that you have never done before, and hopefully something that no one's ever done before, then the fact is it could fail because there's no way to find out except going and doing it and seeing if the world is ready for whatever it is that you're trying to do. So the second thing is then once it's happened, you need to be alert to the possibility that it's not working and to be prepared to stop. And this sounds so dumb, right? I mean, of course, obviously, but people don't do it. I mean, you think you see this with everything from compulsive gamblers, right, who are always trying to go back and win back what they lost, even though gamblers of all people should know that the way casinos stay in business is that the odds in the long run are always in their favor. But you see this also with businesses who they've got a project, they're committed to it, and they can't just say, okay, this didn't work. You see this with people in relationships. How many of us have known those people in a relationship? It was obvious to everyone else and kind of obvious to them that the relationship wasn't working out, but they stayed in that relationship longer and longer, letting time go by, wasting precious years of their lives on a relationship rather than going and finding a better one, because they were afraid to admit that it hadn't worked out. So there are ways to get better at doing that, and I talk about that in the book. And then the third thing is, like, once you've recognized that there's been a failure, you need to be future-oriented rather than past-oriented. You need to say, okay, well, this happened. I'm not a failure. I am someone who failed. And again, that sounds kind of obvious, but really, you look at any successful person from Abraham Lincoln to Winston Churchill to any business person you admire, any athlete you admire, all of those people can tell you stories of soul-shattering failures. Abraham Lincoln was a serial failure before he became president. And so you have to say to yourself, I'm not a failure. Just like Abraham Lincoln, I am someone who has failed. What can I learn from that? And then I have to close the books. And instead of kind of just beating myself up with shame and regret, say, okay, I tried something. It didn't work. This is what I've learned from it. That is really useful information. And now I have to let go of that, and I have to go forward to the next thing.
And I have to say that this was not only the part of the book that I thought was maybe the most valuable advice, or again, it's not an advice book. It's a fascinatingly constructed book that I can't wait to ask you about some of the worst date of your life and some other things. We're going to get into some of the personal autobiographical things. But some of the most sage counsel in that part where you say, look, you have to know essentially or learn to be able to let go a little bit when it isn't working. I'm reading that going, that is absolutely vital. But how many people do you know who would say, that's giving up. I'm not going to give up. I'm reading that going, that's so important, but I don't know how practical it is to people who feel like taking that route would be giving up a dream.
Yes. And so there's a fine line, because it's also true that you need perseverance to succeed at anything, right? And there are lots of marriages where people, I think probably anyone who's been married for 40 years can tell you about a time that they really felt like they'd reached the end and they couldn't go on anymore. And then they persevered and they're still married and happily married and so forth. So here's my answer to that is, and I'm going to take a little bit of a detour, so bear with me. But there's a great line from G.K. Chesterton, who is a great Catholic social writer at the turn of the 20th century. And he said, you know, you have reformers who come along and they say, oh, there's a gate in the road. This is stupid. We should tear it down. And because I don't know why it's here. And he said, that person should never be allowed to touch the gate because the gate didn't just appear there. It was built there for some reason. And if you know what the reason is, you can say, oh, okay, well, it's a bad reason, or it doesn't apply anymore, or we've got a better way to do this. And then, yes, you should be allowed to tear down the gate. But if you just think that it's there for no reason at all, you shouldn't be allowed to touch it. So bringing this back to failure, if you can name to me why things aren't working and a plausible plan for fixing them, then that's a good reason to keep going. So if you can tell me, look, right now we have this technical problem with our product, but we can fix it. But we have a pretty good idea of where to go. Or customers, we weren't in the right location, or customers didn't understand the product, but we've started getting really good word of mouth and it's turning around, right? Those are all good reasons to keep going. My marriage, right now, it's not working, but I understand what the problems are. Maybe it's just that, you know, life gets hard sometimes and we've been stressed, and I can see where that's going to turn around. So the problems that aren't going to get fixed are things like, so in my own relationship, right, I was 33, I wanted to get married, and my boyfriend showed no signs of wanting to get married and then proposed and dumped me immediately afterwards. So
I don't mean to laugh, but I wasn't laughing.
I can laugh now. No, I'm married to a wonderful man now, so it all worked out in the end. But, you know, sticking with that, what I did, which was really stupid, is I kept sticking with it, right? And I knew I wanted to get married, and that's something where you shouldn't just keep gambling, precious. When you have a finite amount of resources, you shouldn't keep gambling with someone who's clearly really reluctant. And I see a lot of women in their 30s make this mistake. And if you take nothing else away from this broadcast, please do not make the mistake. If you've been together for a couple of years and you've still got a reluctant person, like, you're not going to learn more. You're not going to get more information. It's time to leave and go find someone else. But also, you know, with companies that say, well, our problem is that we can't figure out how to get people to pay enough for this product to make it worthwhile. Everyone loves it. They just don't want to pay for it. Well, it's kind of an insoluble problem, right? Either you can get people to pay for it, or you have to say, look, this was a good idea. Obviously, people like the product, but they're not willing to pay enough for it. So if you can't, I just don't know. It's not selling and I can't figure out why, right? That's a sign that after you have to, at the beginning, set deadlines, right? I mean, it always takes some time to get a product off the ground. But if you've missed your milestones and you can't tell me what's going to change, then it's time to say, okay, well, we're not going to get new information. I don't know why it didn't work, but it didn't, and it's time to close the book.
I think that's a well-constructed argument there. Megan McArdle is my guest. She's the author of The Upside of Down, Why Failing Well is the Key to Success. Now, we've talked about this notion that the bad is you know, not going to last as long as you think, and the highs are often not quite as all-consuming as we might hope. And that's a good thing, but there's one exception that you write about. You write that we may adapt to losing the use of our legs, but not the use of our time cards. Unemployment being what is sort of different and set apart from this. Why?
Well, so there's a couple of reasons. One is that it sort of keeps going. You keep being just as unemployed. If you lose the use of your legs, and this is actually an example that really surprised me when I started reading this research, is that people who have really terrible accidents that result in really bad sort of disabilities, those people do acclimate, and they report being about as happy 5 years later as they were before the accident. But being unemployed, you don't get better at being unemployed. You're just still unemployed, right? You don't have new compensations. You're just still unemployed. And so if that just keeps persisting for as long as it persists, people seem to be just about as unhappy. And this is in Europe. This is not here. So it's not a financial problem. These are people with very generous levels of unemployment benefits. It's the disconnect from a sense of purpose, from a work community, from having something to do that really deprives people of the ability to make themselves happy in their lives. And so when you look at the biggest mistakes that we have made over the past 6 years since the financial crisis, I would say the biggest policy mistake that we made is that we're not nearly as aggressive enough about preventing employment from spiking and about getting people back in the labor market. Because right now we have a situation where if you weren't unemployed for that period, then the labor market for you is mostly recovered, is that you have just about as good a chance of getting a job. There's some exceptions. Detroit is a very hard place to find a job, and even now. But in general, for almost everyone in America, your employment prospects are good as long as you basically maintain employment throughout the Great Recession. But if you didn't, if you got stuck in long-term unemployment, you're still facing terrible labor market conditions, very hard to get back into work. And those are people that we really need to worry about, because it's a loss for them. It's obviously a loss for their community, of the people around them. It's very stressful to have a loved one who's unemployed, as my parents can attest. And it's also an economic loss. I mean, that represents a lot of productive labor that instead is having to subsist on something like disability insurance, Social Security, and so forth. It's a very large loss to society, and we weren't nearly aggressive enough about trying to get those people back into work.
And for people who are unemployed, there's kind of a stigma. As you write in the book, you'd think that companies wouldn't hold being unemployed against someone during a rough economy, but they do, and they've even essentially admitted it, going back to advertising we saw in 2010 that lasted about a day and a half, I think. It's just amazing that they would come out and say that they don't want to. Companies don't want to consider people who are unemployed, and that
Absolutely.
Just makes it harder.
And, you know, the companies stopped saying it, but that doesn't mean they stopped discriminating. It just means they stopped telling people up front that they were going to. I'm not even sure that's better, if you just get more people to send out resumes and hope, when there's no hope at all that their resume is going to be considered. You know, it's not entirely irrational for the companies, which is part of the problem, is that, first of all, people who have been, when companies lay off, they do target their least productive workers. And that does not by any means mean that all of the people who've been laid off are unproductive. But even if it's a small minority, right, why not hire from the pool of people who weren't laid off and therefore are likely to be among the higher, more likely to be among the higher productivity workers? So that's number one. The second problem is that people who are laid off actually lose skills. The longer you're laid off, you lose contacts in the industry, you're not up on the latest technology, you haven't done. But also they lose pretty basic skills like reading and math. It's you know, the depression and the disconnect from the labor force has profound impacts on people's psychology. And so employers, if they can, just say to themselves, look, you know, why not hire someone who's already got a job? It's easier. I know that they don't have all of these problems, and so I can avoid that by not hiring. It's rational for the employer, but of course for the rest of us, it's horrifying for the worker having been there. And it's bad for society as a whole. And, you know, we could have done more policies like, say, what if we gave employers we rebated the whole payroll tax, which is 7% on the employee side, 7% on the employer side. What if for every month someone had been unemployed, employers got a break from that whole tax? So it's basically like a 15% wage subsidy. And that could have really made a difference with biasing hiring towards the long-term unemployed, helping to get them out of the really bad place that they've gotten stuck in largely through no fault of their own.
And you are willing to share your own personal stories in the book. In fact, I couldn't help but laugh at the puppets and the date that sort of crystallized everything that was going wrong at that one point in your life. Can you briefly share that story?
Yes. So I was unemployed for 2 years. I was living in my parents' spare room, which is pretty much exactly as lame as it sounds. And I started going out with an investment banking analyst, and he took me to see, so there's this play, it's going up to Broadway, this is its last off-Broadway showing, let's go, I don't know anything about it, it's about puppets. And so all I had been told was that it had puppets in it. And so it turned out to be Avenue Q, which is this really very funny, wonderful musical about losers who are living really, really far out. On the joke is you used to go up Avenue A, Avenue B, Avenue C. They've gotten up to Avenue Q because they're so poor and unemployable. And I was watching this and thinking, wow, but at least the puppets have jobs and they have their own apartments and I'm living with my parents. And I'm thinking, like, is he trying to tell me something? He's sick of buying my meals. And it's really like working myself up into this hideous, hideous state. I just remember bursting out of the theater wanting to cry at the end of it. And the funny thing was that 3 days later, I got offered my dream job at The Economist, which is what has led to an 11-year career in journalism, which has been amazing. And the funny thing was, when I started writing this, I didn't know it had happened so closely. I went back and checked the dates and realized, oh, wow, that must have happened right before I got this job offer. And, you know, it really is true that it's often darkest before the dawn. And that, you know, I have friends who are going through this right now, and it's really discouraging. But the fact is, like, the people who just keep plugging, and I talk about this in the employment chapter a lot, but it's generally applicable, is that just keep trying something. The people who just keep flailing instead are the people who ultimately end up finding something that is, you know, just like Colonel Sanders, picking up and taking his pressure cooker from restaurant to restaurant and just not giving up.
My guest is Megan McArdle, the author of The Upside of Down, Why Failing Well is the Key to Success. The book is out now. Now, on the flip side of the notion of stigma, in this country, if you've launched a startup company and that company failed, in some ways, do you get points for trying? Should that be a point in the column that says go for it, because, you know, you're viewed with some level of respect if you launched something, even if it didn't pan out beautifully right away?
Oh, yeah, no, Silicon Valley is great at this. And more broadly, America is just better than most places at dealing with people who failed. We're kinder to failures. We say, oh, you tried, and that's great, and it could happen to anyone, right? And that's because we're kind of a nation of failures. I mean, pretty much everyone listening to this broadcast, how did your ancestors get here? With very few exceptions, obviously, Native Americans, African Americans. But otherwise, how did your ancestors get here? They got here because things weren't working out at home. And there were the people who, when things didn't work out, picked up and went somewhere else. And that combination of being willing to move on and to forgive failures has bred an extraordinarily forgiving failure culture. And it's sort of at its most extreme in Silicon Valley, but you see it all over America much more than in other places. And it's one of the keys to our economic success that it's really underrated, is this ability to look at someone who's failed and not say, oh, well, they just must be stupid or have bad judgment or whatever, but to say, wow, that is someone who took risks. And that is valuable. That is someone who tried something, or maybe even just someone who got stuck in a bad place, but gosh, he's out there looking for another job right now, and he is trying, and I admire that, and I want to help that out, rather than saying I want to shun it and get away from it because it might be contagious.
Megan, before I let you go here, you write about economics as part of your work as a journalist. How is this country's general climate when it comes to supporting and offering opportunity for people who do want to take risks and launch their own ventures, et cetera?
Well, you know, I think that in general it's better than the rest of the world. I also think we're getting worse. We're getting worse at kind of every level. If you see how with our kids, I don't know if you saw that a parent was arrested for allowing their 11-year-old child to sit in a car by herself on a hot day. I mean, you know, it's not like an 11-year-old child is going to sit in a car and suffocate to death. They can get out if it's too hot in the car. But we've somehow lost all judgment in terms of how much we should protect kids, how much we should protect ourselves. That we're getting much, much more risk-averse, and then we're translating that into making sure that no one else takes any risks either, even really tiny risks like leaving an 11-year-old child not strapped into a car, because you should never leave a very small child in a car, but an 11-year-old should be exploring the world, not sort of tethered to their parents so tightly that they can never get away for a second. And, you know, we're translating that economically, is that we're increasingly much more focused on risk avoidance than we are on prudent risk-taking and innovation. And the problem with that is that ultimately, I like to say, there's nowhere as dangerous as safe, because if we avoid risks, if we don't focus on innovation, if we try to make it so that nothing can ever go wrong, we're also making it so that nothing can ever go right, so that we cannot discover all of the new things that we need to deal with the phenomenal challenges of the 21st century. We have an aging population. We have a changing global marketplace. We need to be taking more smarter risks, minimizing the downside, but getting out there and innovating more, because otherwise we're going to end up being left behind with a declining standard of living. And instead we're going in the opposite direction. It's like we're fighting to preserve what we have instead of looking for new frontiers.
Megan McArdle, the author of The Upside of Down, Why Failing Well is the Key to Success. The book is out now. You can read her work in many places, but also on Bloomberg View, among others. And Megan, great stuff and very interesting and provocative. And I appreciate you taking the time to join us on the program today.
Well, I am so happy to talk to Western New York, the most beautiful spot on earth, and a place where I spent a lot of happy hours as a child.
See, that's confirmation bias. You just you want to think it. No, I do agree. I think it is the most beautiful place.
I say this to everyone I have ever spoken to about Western New York, most beautiful spot on earth, and always happy to get back up there, even if it's only over the telephone.
Cheers, and thanks for the time, Megan.
Thank you.
All right, we're going to take the shortest break in radio. When we come back, we're going to hear from some local entrepreneurs and business owners who've been listening and are going to join the conversation about risk, failure, and learning to build great success. That's next on member-supported public radio. Coming up in our second hour, Hobart and William Smith Colleges are defending the way they handled a sexual assault claim last year. The story landed on the front page of the New York Times, with the Times writing that the college was ill-prepared to handle the claim and seemed to ignore key pieces of evidence. We ask the question, should colleges change how they investigate sexual assault claims? That's coming up next hour.
I'm Robin Young. Scotland votes on independence from the UK in September, but opinion still seems to be mixed.
I would be a yes. Might as well give it a go.
I find the evidence so far very conflicting.
That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This afternoon at 2 o'clock, right here on your public radio station, WXXI and WEOS.
I'm Evan Dawson. Welcome back to Connections on this Monday afternoon. And now we want to welcome our panel, kind of a roundtable of entrepreneurs who are going to talk more about the subjects you just heard from author Megan McArdle. In studio, we have Alex Zapisochny, who is a tech entrepreneur, among other things. Alex, the current company you're with is?
iCardiac Technologies.
iCardiac Technologies. Jim Sinal's here with High Tech Rochester. Jim, nice to see you here.
Thank you, Evan. Great to be here.
Mike Totterman from iCardiac is here as well. Nice to see you, Mike.
Pleasure to be here.
But I say iCardiac, and your history, you have some other ventures in your background and past, don't you?
I do. I used to do venture capital, actually, on the West Coast with a fund, and then another startup here, and then some other startups on the West Coast as well.
So let me start with you, Mike. You just heard Megan McArdle talking about the value of failure, challenges for whether you're starting a business or dealing with unemployment or want to get back and build a success. What did you think?
I think she's absolutely on point. Most of the time, you know, folks learn the lessons that she described fairly late in their lives, essentially through a lot of practice. I think there used to be this belief that, you know, successful life is linear. You have a little bit of success, then you have more success and more success. But I think most of folks' successes, especially people who've done startups, is there's a lot of experiments that don't go well. You've got to learn from those, and then you move on and you do better.
And what is iCardiac?
Actually, that's a great example of a lot of iteration. We provide cardiac safety services for pharmaceutical companies. And actually, in our case, the primary technology that we were looking to market and validate for the first 3 years was actually not the product that ended up selling. And it was a fortuitous set of customer interactions that eventually led to something that has now scaled very, very well.
Okay. So there was a misfire or just a misdirection early in the company that required some adaptation to find success?
Yeah. And the way we often think about it nowadays, there's a very famous venture capitalist on the West Coast who wrote a book on how to get to plan B because plan A never works. And in entrepreneurship, at least in my case, I've not run into a situation where I've invested in a company or started a company where plan A actually was what was the scalable component. So, and I didn't realize that until I had been working on this for a while and compared some stories. So nowadays, you know, when we start a project, we say, here's the plan. We know it's going to change. If it doesn't change, we're probably doing something wrong.
Alex, what stood out to you from the interview?
Well, I think Megan McArdle is making a point that's quite important, and it's a point that especially in the entrepreneurial community in some ways has been a huge element of focus. And in fact, there are methodologies now that have been created to help entrepreneurs that are actually centered on the idea of how important failure is, but that it's important to fail very fast. Mike mentioned this book by Randy Komisar, Getting the Plan B. But in reality, very few even figured out a plan B, and it's not really so much a failure as it is something else. There's also this broader movement that started 4 or 5 years ago called the Lean Startup Movement. And actually, Jim Sinal, when he speaks, he and High Tech Rochester deserve a ton of credit for bringing this methodology here. It's already been used to help dozens of entrepreneurs here start companies. But the whole concept is that when you're starting a company, you shouldn't think of your startup as just a small version of a big company. In reality, you don't have a business plan so much. All you have is a bunch of assumptions about what you think people need and kind of what form your particular solution should take. And the whole concept is don't actually go into your garage or the lab or wherever it is that you think you're going to spend time doing working in technology, spending all of your money and months or years trying to perfect it. Instead, basically take what's called a minimum viable product, just enough. Maybe it's a sketch, maybe it's a PowerPoint, just enough information to convey what it is you think you're doing. And then go off and have conversations where you're not selling, you're just talking to people who are in the know and providing them information, getting feedback. And what's been shown is that entrepreneurs who can do this, who could have dozens, hundreds of conversations, just conversations, end up having so much more success because they're over time they learn what doesn't work, experience these little failures. Then the key is to actually understand what to do with these failures and to then iterate quickly, or maybe even not iterations. Maybe they're bigger than that. Maybe they're pivots. But get to something that actually represents something that people need. And in Silicon Valley, this has led to so many different companies now being successful, and this is a methodology that's now being employed even in larger companies, as well as in the social entrepreneurship space and in other nonprofit sectors. But failure is absolutely the key to success.
I should have mentioned this earlier, but if you want to join the conversation, we'd love to hear from our listeners. What have you learned from your own failures in work and business and life and sort of turning a failure into the springboard to a greater success? The number is toll-free, 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, or right here in Rochester, 263-WXXI, 263-9994. Now, Jim, what Alex is talking about is the kind of person who is thinking about their business beyond just how do I make a great product? I got to make something great, or I got to have a great service. You start to think scalable. You start to think about possible problems that could come down the road. And a lot of people who want to launch something, they just want to dive into the product or dive into the service. You know, I mean that's where their passion lies. And you're asking them to think a little bit more broadly.
Absolutely right. The tendency for a lot of folks is to dive in, particularly if it's a technology-related founder, or you know, I want to build this software, build this product. You want to just build it, make it perfect, raise money, and once you build it, they will come. And in reality, it just doesn't work that way. So as Alex mentioned, you know, getting people to get out there and talk with customers, see if what they have has any value, does anybody want it, is extremely valuable. And it almost sounds like common sense, right? Go talk to the market, see if customers want what you're thinking about, but historically, people haven't done that. I was involved in startups myself 10, 15 years ago. We didn't do that. They ended up being catastrophic failures.
Are you willing to give us more specifics?
Well, one company that raised $6.5 million and spent years developing a product that in the end, you know, had we been out truly listening to what the market was saying, probably would not have spent nearly that amount of money and would have said, hey, look, these other technologies are out there and are probably eating our lunch. And we would have learned that and not, you know, driven into the wall at 60 miles an hour when we ran out of money.
How valuable was that lesson for you?
Hugely valuable. It changed the way I look at things. And then when we saw the Lean Startup methodology, it kind of crystallized and said, you know, there's a process, there's a way you can teach people how to do this. You can lead them through the development process. And it just makes a world of difference. And the companies we've had in our HTR Launchpad for software companies and Nexus for clean tech companies and others in their incubators, it's amazing how many times they will say, man, I wish I would have started this program a year ago. I would have saved a year. And so the idea is iterations, small failures, cheap failures, avoid those catastrophic failures as you understand what the market wants.
We're talking about business success and failure, and we already have a question online from Jennifer, who wants to know if your panel can share a little bit more information about how startup companies can find funding. That's a broad question, but I also understand that sometimes, and Mike, you're already raising your hand, sometimes you feel like, you know, I've got this great product or service, but finding a way to translate that into something that's viable. Part of your work has been involved in making some of those decisions, hasn't it, Mike?
Absolutely. And I think nowadays that this lean methodology is becoming also known to the investors. I would say the best way to find funding is to first answer the question, what is the customer base and how is the customer base clamoring for what you are particularly looking to deliver? If you have an ability to articulate that and you have referenceable customers, now you can have a conversation around funding. What used to happen, and that's probably what the question is in relation to, you used to be able to get funding to develop an idea. Nowadays, the idea has to already be developed to some degree, and you have to be at a point where you say, hey, I've got this set of customers. They've bought off on this concept. Now I just need to execute in implementing the product, and they will buy that. So the bar is a little bit higher, but it is also making it a lot easier for everybody because there's less time and money and effort wasted.
That reminds me, by the way, of the publishing industry. You know, years ago, it used to be that a publisher would love an idea for, say, nonfiction, et cetera. They'd fund the research. Now they like you to come to them and say, this work is largely done. Do you want it? But, Mike, that doesn't mean that someone should invest millions of dollars just hoping it's a good idea and then eventually someone else will put the money into launch it.
Absolutely. And at least in my experience, one of the best things to do, especially before you put any of your own money into it, is to make sure that you've talked to enough customers and you have enough conviction that if you do build it, they will actually purchase it. So the logic is put on its head, but it allows you to be much more astute about where you're spending your time. And that was very similar to how we did iCardiac. We had a number of conversations with pharmaceutical companies asking them, you know, is there an issue in characterizing cardiac safety? If we were to build a company and business around it, would they be very likely users? And we got one step beyond it. They said, you know, not only would we be users, we'd actually be willing to spend some money in having you develop the product. So that for that, that was a big green light and said, okay, now it makes sense to put some of our own money into it as well.
Alex, have you ever failed?
Sure, but except I don't have a particularly negative view of that word. And I know that Megan McArdle actually focuses on this quite a bit in her work. She actually builds a lot on the work of a Stanford professor by the name of Carol Dweck that talks about the importance of this thing called the growth mindset and that they're almost really two different kinds of people. And there are people who look at something that may be termed a failure and basically say, this is what I am. I failed and therefore I'm a failure and that's kind of the end of it. And the reason they think that is because in their minds, what they are, whether it's their intelligence or ability, their capacity to spot a good product or trend or the ability to learn is a fixed point. For those who have this growth mindset, and I would say that almost all of the successful entrepreneurs I've ever met have a growth mindset, they don't think or encounter a failure and say, wow, this means I'm just no good. My capacities are fixed and this means I'm just not very good at this. In reality, they look at every single failure as an opportunity to put together a number of different scenarios and just see, does this work? Doesn't it not work? And they almost relish the ability to build upon the things that they learn over time. So yes, I have proudly failed at many things. And in reality, a lot of those things were at iCardiac because, as Mike mentioned, when we initially went to the University of Rochester, they told us about a couple of different technologies. And one was this amazing technology that everybody was certain was the next greatest thing that was going to change everything. And they also threw in this other technology that they said, well, this is something we kind of developed along the way just to be able to compare how good this other technology is. And of course, the way it turned out, it was that comparator technology, that thing that they sort of threw in along with the license that has become the basis of 70% of what we do. And when you look deeper, there were about five or six other distinct product types that we actually looked at, including trying to test kids that were taking ADHD medications, testing veterans that were taking multiple medications, all these different variations, all of which didn't quite work out. But I would say every single one of them we learned from and we typically built on top of to get to where we are today.
One of the parts of the conversation with Megan McArdle that struck me the most, and in the book, that notion of knowing when to pull back or knowing when it's not working, and her construction of how to go about that, I think, is so valuable. To actually ask the questions, this isn't working, can I articulate why? And am I rationalizing, or is there a reason that it's currently not working, but it's going to turn? That it's one of the most difficult things, Jim, I would think, for any small business owner and entrepreneur.
Very difficult. And I can't tell you how many keynote speeches I've been to over the years of successful entrepreneurs who pitch, never give up.
Right.
I given up, I wouldn't be, you know, had the billion-dollar exit. And so it's really, really hard. I think Megan's, you know, description or guidance is a good one. As long as you're honest with yourself, because you can also fool yourself into saying, okay, it's not working now because X, Y, and Z. Now I'm going to go, that didn't work either. Okay, now I'm going to go fix that. So you got to be honest with yourself. You got to understand. And I think it goes back to you know, the market interaction and talking with customers and listening to what they have to say. You know, if the customers are telling you, yeah, even if you can do that, it's not that big a deal to us, or it changes the way you have to do our job or our paradigm. Then you do have to be prepared to stop. And another thing, you know, another suggestion I've heard other entrepreneurs give is, you know, almost like when you go gambling, you have a stop limit. I'm only going to spend X amount. Well, if you hit that limit in time, money, whatever, be prepared to stop and you know, actually do it.
Marco online says the most valuable thing a successful entrepreneur or business owner can have is a right-hand man or woman who will be able to tell them no.
That's actually a great point. And mm-hmm. we were talking to Megan McArdle, who mostly writes for The Atlantic. And actually this current edition of The Atlantic talks about creative partnerships. And one of the big stories was basically John Lennon and Paul McCartney. And so people have actually done this kind of research, and usually it's exactly what it is. What they have found typically is that the people who are the most creative, whether that's in the artistic sense or from the entrepreneurship sense, aren't necessarily people with better ideas. They're people who've just had many more ideas, but they've also had this some sort of kind of filter or feedback mechanism, usually a partner, a founder or two, that have also known when to say, you know, that one's way better than those other eight ideas you came up with this morning. Let's try this one. And you see that over and over. You see it actually in Steve Jobs and Wozniak as one example. But there's so many in Silicon Valley. Almost all of the kind of these myths around entrepreneurs being these solo practitioners are actually not true when you really look at it. Typically, they've had people who could, exactly as you said, be able to say no.
I can, as a native Clevelander, I can relate everything to LeBron James if you ask me to. And 4 years ago, LeBron James, as a businessman, needed someone to tell him, no, the way you're going to leave Cleveland is not the right way to do it. You can leave, but you can't go on TV and stab a city in the back. No one could tell him no. He did it, and it hurt him. And he admitted that. Dan Gilbert, the Cavs owner, writes this juvenile letter, and no one could tell him, you can't do this. Now, the nice thing to know is, those were two failures. Look at it now. They built out of it. And so, look, again, anything goes back to LeBron James for a living. But there is hope to that. And, you know, for me, you look at Megan's book and all these great examples. There are so many great examples that I had no idea the failures involved. I had no idea that Colonel Sanders was broke at 65. Now, most people who are broke at 65 are not going to build huge, huge global companies, but it's nice to know that you can. And so let me turn the conversation to what's possible locally now. I asked Megan McArdle about the current climate and her view as an economics writer. And she said her concern is that in this country we're still too risk-averse with policy and approach to business, et cetera. I don't want to get overly political, but I'd like to go around the room and ask, here in the Rochester Finger Lakes area, are we receptive enough and are we open enough to risk, or are we too risk-averse when it comes to policy and approach? Jim?
I'm not sure on an absolute basis, but I know comparatively I think we're much more open to risk than we were 10 years ago in this community. And I say that because of, you know, we deal with entrepreneurs all the time. We deal with the political folks, elected officials, and more people today talk about failure is not a bad thing. You know, if 10 years ago, I also run the Rochester Angel Network. And so 10 years ago, if you came to an investor in our community and you had a catastrophic failure in previous startups, you were almost with the scarlet letter, you know, you're not going to get funded again. Who would want to invest in a failure? And I think today that's changed a lot. People recognize they've learned a lot. I'd rather invest in someone that's failed than someone that's never done it before. And so I see a lot of those things pointing in the right direction. I do see some policy that's changing and trying to encourage more startup activity and risk-taking at the state level in particular. And so I think those are all building blocks that kind of point to a good direction.
Yeah, you know, I remember, I go back years now, I remember when I graduated school and a buddy of mine was in investments and trading, and his roommate, quote-unquote, blew up in his first year. And I said, so what do you mean blew up? He said, well, he basically lost more money than you can ever imagine for his company. I said, well, he'll probably never work in the field again. He said, no, quite the contrary. You can blow up once and you have a value, because it's often considered that you learn from that mistake, and that sort of cements the fact that you're not likely to blow up again. And I thought, how interesting that you can fail so badly and yet be viewed as wiser for it. Mike, how do you view, if you're looking to invest and someone has a big failure in their past, does that deter you?
No, not at all. I think the biggest thing is to make sure that the individual has learned from it. Ultimately, you know, having run a business and failed at it, you've still most likely taken away a tremendous amount of learning to perfect the next one. I'm just thinking of myself, the first startup that we did, this was in the, you know, internet bubble years in Silicon Valley. You know, we lost all the money within 6 months. And I look back to that and said, that was the longest list of bad decisions I've ever made in the shortest period of time. But I've never repeated those same decisions again. So then the next time we did a startup, that went better. We, you know, the first one, we couldn't get a single customer, lost all the money. The second one, we got a bunch of customers, got revenue, company went public, but we never built a business model that was highly profitable. And now with iCardiac, we've done that and built a profitable business model. So I think, you know, failure is, and I would even take a, you know, smaller or a little tweak to what Megan said is, you know, I think it's not even an individual failed, it's a project that failed, because project is a composition of individuals, teammates, and then you figure out how do we do it better next time. So I cherish failure, and if you're not failing on something every day, as Megan said, you're not trying hard enough.
I want to start to wrap by shifting the conversation to what entrepreneurialism actually is. And Duncan Moore, who is a University of Rochester professor, who you gentlemen know well, obviously, he has talked about the difference between a small business owner and an entrepreneur. And one of the biggest differences is scalability, that an entrepreneur is creating something that can scale to a different level, that can become, let me go around the room and ask. Is it, start with you, Jim, is that a fair description of the difference between entrepreneurialism and small business?
Well, I think small business owners that start their own small businesses are entrepreneurs. You know, they're creating a company and they're creating a lifestyle and building, you know, a lifestyle company. There certainly is a difference, though, between that and trying to build a scalable company that, you know, is going to generate, you know, more wealth. Is typically going to require investment.
Yeah.
And it's a very different animal.
And at High Tech Rochester, how often do you hear from people who have ideas but haven't thought about how to make it scalable or haven't considered scalability?
We meet with probably 250 people a year with ideas. Probably most of those haven't really thought through the process yet of is it scalable or not? How would it be scalable? What's the business model? And that's where a lot of these tools and techniques with Lean Startup and business model canvases and things really help, you know, lay these things out so they can start doing iterations on it to understand, do you want to take this risk or not? Do you want to dive in and create your company? Or maybe, as Mike said earlier, you got to convince yourself first that it's worth doing before you can convince others.
You ever said to somebody, we're saying no because we're trying to save you a bunch of money?
We give people honest feedback.
Yeah. If they want to get in touch and really start that process, how do they find you?
The easiest way is either calls or go to our website, htr.org.
So as we start to wrap the hour, and again, if you're just joining us, earlier this hour we had a chance to have a conversation with economics writer and author Megan McArdle, who has a new book out called The Upside of Down, Why Failing Well is the Key to Success. We've been talking to Jim Sinal from High Tech Rochester, Mike Totterman from iCardiac and with a venture capitalist background, Alex Zapasochny from iCardiac, who's a tech entrepreneur. Alex, you have worked in you know, not just for iCardiac, but do you get the sense now that with what you're doing and the climate locally, there are more opportunities for people than ever before locally, or do you feel that it's somewhat difficult for entrepreneurs? What's the climate like right now?
I mean, I think there's no doubt that the climate is so much better now than it was 10 or 15 years ago when you kind of still had the overhang of the big three. And I do recall when I moved back to town 14 years ago, for those individuals who had started something and then it didn't work out, you know, they were going to run into people at Wegmans or whatever, and people would kind of say, oh, that's the guy that failed. And it was going to be basically impossible to get funded. I definitely don't get the sense that's the case anymore. The other thing that I'm very happy about, and this is more of a development in the last few years, and it goes to Megan McArdle's key point that you have to find ways to fail kind of forward and fail well, is that there are now opportunities for people more than ever to actually practice at entrepreneurship. So for instance, High Tech Rochester, as well as the Farish Foundation, recently sponsored the Startup Weekend. And that's a perfect example. If you want to know whether you should be a small business owner or whether you should be an entrepreneur that's creating a scalable business, go and join those teams. Don't worry about the money. Just figure out and cycle through as many experiences as possible being a part of some sort of entrepreneurial experience. And I think that once you do, you relatively quickly figure out whether or not this is for you.
We're going to continue to have conversations about entrepreneurialism in Western New York, the Finger Lakes area. We'll see you back here soon as we tackle more of these issues. But Alex, Mike, Jim, thanks for your perspective on the issue.
Great. Thank you, Evan.
And our thanks to Megan McArdle. We're coming right back and talking about what's going on at Hobart and William Smith. Stay here for that.